From Studio 49 in Albuquerque, this is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. Earlier this month, the restaurant chain Panera announced they would be removing 150 artificial additives from their food. It's another voice in the growing movement to reduce the amount of chemicals in the food we consume. But where does Native America fit into this conversation? Are you concerned about toxins in your traditional foods? And just what kind of chemicals should you be concerned about? That's next, right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Obama administration has decided to allow Shell Oil Company to drill in the Arctic near Alaska. The company must secure additional permits before it can proceed. But the green light from the Interior Department topples a hurdle that's prevented drilling there for years. Some tribal leaders say it's only a matter of time before an oil spill happens in the remote and environmentally sensitive region, which will alter their way of life. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
The Department of Interior gave conditional approval for Shell's exploration plan for the chilly waters off the coast of Alaska. The petroleum company has leased parts of the Chukchi Sea, which sits northwest of Alaska's outer continental shelf, but have faced several hurdles in attempts to drill. But some tribal communities and environmentalists have serious doubts about Shell's ability to run a clean and safe operation in Arctic waters. They point to a Shell drill rig that ran aground in 2012. More recently, operators of a Shell-contracted ship were found guilty of felony maritime violations and fined over $12 million. Patty Goldman is a managing attorney with Earth Justice, a nonprofit advocacy group that she says has worked with Alaskan natives who are dependent on the natural resources there.
In Alaska, we have represented Alaska natives in the various challenges to Arctic drilling and the permits. So definitely up there, and you know, they're right up there in ground zero. And the area where this drilling would happen is right in the migratory area for the bowhead whales, which they hunt, and walruses are at risk. And, you know, so there are a lot of very direct effects on the way of life of the Alaska natives.
Goldman's group is challenging Shell's proposed use of the Port of Seattle as a staging area for the project. She says a full-scale drilling operation will not only affect fisheries and wildlife negatively, but that the area's isolation can also complicate cleanup in the event of a spill. Shell didn't respond to requests for comment. John Callahan is a spokesman for the Alaska region of the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management, an office of the Interior Department. He says the agency has taken Shell's past experiences into consideration and says there are many misconceptions regarding the agency's latest decision. He stressed that what's been approved is merely an exploration plan, and that Native Alaskan groups have been fully consulted.
We maintain a very close relationship. We call it government-to-government consultations with the Native tribes, the local communities along the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, and a variety of other Native organizations as well. For example, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission would be an example of one.
Alaska Republican Senator Dan Sullivan says his state has a track record of thoughtful balance between the environment and energy needs. He, along with fellow Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young, hammered that talking point home during a press conference in January when the White House deemed Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, or ANWR, off-limits to development. Sullivan admits not all Alaskans are on board, but says he sees a lot of support.
The vast majority of the tribal leaders I know, and I can tell you this in very strong terms, are supportive of responsible resource development.
Reports say once Shell obtains the remaining permits, they can begin exploratory drilling as early as July. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Hopi tribe is again demanding the return of sacred objects from a Paris auction house. This has been an ongoing fight for the Arizona tribe to protect items sacred to Hopi people from being sold in France. The tribe says it received notice of a June 1st auction. The catalog includes objects of Native American origin. The tribe is asking for state, local, federal, and congressional support. A special Hopi Tribal Council meeting to address the auction is scheduled for Thursday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. Last month, the restaurant chain Panera announced that they would be eliminating 150 chemicals from their food. The reason? Here's a clip from the video put out by the company of people trying to pronounce the names of the chemicals in food.
Tert-buti-hydro-kinui.
Tert-butyl-hydroquinol.
These aren't real words.
Azocarbonamide.
Azocarbonamide?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Panera isn't the only restaurant rethinking their menu. Last year, Subway made changes to its sandwiches after it was taken to task over an additive in their bread that's also used in yoga mats. Chick-fil-A also recently announced that it would switch to antibiotic-free chicken and remove dyes from their sauces. Change seems to be coming, but is it too little, too late? Especially when some of the toxins being removed from restaurant menus are in the environment and in many of our traditional foods. Are you concerned about the chemicals found in your food? Would you like to see more regulation of chemicals found in our food? Give us a call. The phone lines are open. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can also go to our Facebook page and post a comment or send us a tweet at 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now is Valerie Segrist. She is the Muckleshoot Traditional Food and Medicine Program Manager. And Valerie is Muckleshoot. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Valerie.
Thank you so much for having me again.
So, Valerie, when I go to the grocery store and I want to buy something and I make the mistake of looking at the labels and reading the ingredients, and suddenly I find myself not being able to eat anything because I can't understand any of the chemicals on the ingredient list, what suggestions do you have for circumstances like this?
Well, you should probably go get a scientific degree so you can make a choice. Just joking. I think it is pretty anxiety provoking when we walk through our grocery store these days and are also being told a certain story about what's in our foods. And my advice would be to take your ancestors grocery shopping with you. You know, what would they recognize as food? Probably not anything that comes in a package. Probably not even the way our meats are prepared and put into butchery aisles where they're all pristine and perfect and saran wrapped. However, the whole foods that are available in our grocery stores, the seasonality of that produce department, the local availability, those things are all pretty important to consider.
Well, we're talking about chemicals in our food today, and Valerie Segrist is with us. She's a Muckleshoot Traditional Food and Medicine Program Manager, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Have you ever found yourself in the grocery store just bewildered, not sure what to choose, not sure what things are good for you and what things are not so good for you? We want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1 996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Valerie, are there some chemicals in food that we should absolutely be concerned about and absolutely not be consuming, in your opinion?
Yes, I do have that concern for some of the things. For example, BHT, which is something that came out in the 80s and was sort of a hot ticket item. It was sprayed on vegetables and fruits to keep them crisp and fresh. And then after they found out that it was causing asthma issues with people, it was removed from the food, but it is still actually used to spray on packaging. So they don't have to put it on the food, but they can put it on the package, like cereals. So they spray BHT on the plastic bag that your cereals come in. That, to me, is where we all need to be sort of one step ahead, you know, here, because there's legislation and things that get passed and attention that's drawn. But then instead of just removing it entirely, the use of that toxin is the direction is shifted. So it's about really being intentional when we are requesting certain policy to be passed about how people might, you know, circumvent the true request, which is like, don't spray stuff on our food. It's going to make us sick. Is it that complicated?
Yeah, I wonder if it is, but it does seem like there's a lot of going around in the media. There's a particular blogger named The Food Babe who has got some attention because she, I think she was the one who pointed out the Subway bread and the what was the same chemical in yoga mats. But Valerie, you know, are there any chemicals that maybe we shouldn't be worried about? I've heard that the cellulose is something that they put in shredded cheese to sort of separate it, but it's just wood pulp. It's not, you know, some sort of dangerous chemical.
Well, I think we have to be really mindful that when you start studying all of the things that go into our food, it sort of becomes a slippery slope, and before you know it, you're, you know, in the drive-through of Burger King having a panic attack because you have to order some food for a homework assignment or something like that, just because there is a condition called orthorexia where you actually know too much about what's in your food, and that inhibits and limits what you choose to eat. So instead of purchasing, you know, this, it even gets down to the specific carrot. Like, I will not buy this carrot because it does not have the green tops on it and I don't see dirt on it. You know, people will get that specific about their choices, and that can limit the diversity in your diet. However, you know, it is something to consider. It is a concern to have, you know, cellulose is not really something you can go out in nature and harvest and make and prepare yourself in your kitchen. You know what I mean? There's almond milk, for example, which is all the craze right now. And I don't really have much of a problem with it because I know I can go to the store, buy almonds, whack them up in my blender, and make an almond milk. I know that that processed product is also able to be processed in my own kitchen. I don't know how to process high fructose corn syrup in my kitchen, and I don't even know if that knowledge is available to the public. So certain ingredients are important to consider. You know, would I just go take a handful of wood pulp and munch on it? Probably not. But in moderate amounts, it's probably okay.
Well, Valerie, you know, you mentioned crying in the line at the food, you know, line at Burger King. Was that an experience that you had when you were in school learning to become a nutritionist?
Yes. When I was in school, I had a class called Psychology of Nourishment, and that was our homework. mean, if you can imagine being in a room of 20-something women who are studying nutrition and really in it, obsessed with their diet totally, and every single one of us was diagnosed with orthorexia, our homework was to go eat at a drive-thru. And I hadn't eaten fast food in years, and it was a panic, anxiety-inducing state of mind. It was one of the toughest homework assignments I've ever had. And I also look back to that and think, wow, you know, the power that food has on the choices that we have to make every single day of our life when hunger hits us is may not seem at the forefront like a really stressful, you know, concern or decision that we have to make, but it in fact does have some things that are going on inside of our body producing some stress, you know, around just decisions that we had to make. And that is very different from our traditional diets where it was about bringing community together and being out in nature and celebrating the reciprocity that happens when we get our hands in the dirt and our bare feet on the earth, eating huckleberries at the ripeness of the season and feeling good.
We're talking about chemicals in our food today. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Let's go to the phones. We've got Etta in Kamiai, Idaho, listening on KIYE. Etta, what would you like to share today?
Hello. Thank you for letting me talk. I wanted to say that I'm a cancer survivor. And as a cancer survivor, I did a lot of research on the foods that I ate and that my family ate. And nowadays, a lot of kids are consuming top ramen, those noodles. And I went to that and looked at it and found out that the top ramen noodles are lined with styrofoam. So I told my kids, I said, you don't need to eat those noodles no more. That's just not good for you. The more you eat it, the more it's going to hurt you. So they quit eating it. My whole family quit eating it.
Etta, was it hard for your family to stop eating ramen? I have somebody in my life who is a ramen, loves ramen more than anything. And we definitely had to say, well, you might have to have a little less of this. Was it hard for you guys to give it up?
It was hard for them. It wasn't hard for me, but because as a cancer survivor, it was hard to find food to eat when I was going through it, the cancer and the chemotherapy. It's hard to find food in like where I'm from. I'm 70 miles away from where my cancer doctor was, and I had to travel down there. So when I'd get down there, you know, I was hungry, but you couldn't go get something fast food because it just wasn't able, you know, to eat it. So it was hard all the way through that cancer, you know, and I know how it is for cancer people. It's hard to find food that you can eat and consume.
Etta, thank you so much for sharing that with us today, and good luck in the future with, you know, your battles with cancer and also making good choices about the food that you eat. Valerie, what kind of substitutions can folks make? For example, if they decide, that's it with the ramen, I can't eat this anymore. What would you suggest to replace that?
You could try, you know, ramen is actually a really beautiful food culture from Japan, and you could look up recipes on how those things are prepared traditionally and maybe try a traditional version of it. We're very fortunate, you know, here right up the road, we've got several traditional ramen spots. And so we were able to make that transition in our diet by eating at those restaurants and trying those things out and then making our own ramen soup with bone broth and involving your own traditional foods fusion with that. I think of, you know, an elk bone broth with those fresh noodles, which they now make gluten-free, and adding a hard-boiled egg in it. It's just before lunch hour here, so I'm starting to get hungry, obviously.
Me too.
That would be, like, you know, we can choose to feel challenged and defeated by this, or we can see it as an opportunity and an empowering moment to bring together our ancient wisdom and apply that to a modern diet.
I like that. Chemicals, choosing to know about the chemicals, but also choosing to take on the challenge to change your diet. Well, let's add some more voices to the conversation. Joining us now from Portland, Oregon is Dr. Diane Barton. She's the water quality coordinator for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and she is Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Welcome, Dr. Barton.
I'm glad to be here, Monica.
And also joining us is Dr. Barbara Harper. She's a consultant with 20 years experience working on toxins in Indian country, and she is a board certified toxicologist. Welcome, Dr. Harper.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to expand this conversation. We've been talking about food that we buy in the grocery stores, the chemicals we can't explain or even pronounce, and how we can transition those out of our diets. But for many in Native America, we also consume our traditional foods. And Diane, I wanted to throw that to you. Are we concerned, or should we be concerned, about the toxins that are in our traditional foods?
Yes, I think we do. Some of the evidence that we see in, particularly in fish, that's what the focus is of the commission, Fish Commission that I work for. We see traditional foods accumulating toxic chemicals from the food web. And, you know, this becomes a responsibility for all the population living on the earth as we go to make choices that Valerie talked about in the marketplace. You have to realize that some of the chemicals that you're consuming, and not just in foods, but like in triclosan and hand cleaner and hand sanitizer, that goes through your body, down the drain, into our common shared waters, and then that gets taken by some of our traditional foods, which are healthier, but then we see this continuing exposure of ourselves and our foods to these chemicals.
Barbara, how can we know the levels of these toxins in our traditional foods? Is there a test or something that gives us an idea?
That's not an easy question. The chemical analysis is very expensive and complex. Now, EPA does track some things other federal agencies do as well, but it's not easy to find out, especially in a local setting. Like Diane said, we generally know quite a bit about what's in fish, but getting information for a specific species in a specific waterway is very difficult. So it's really hard to know what's in the native food from, say, general commercial chemicals. And then if you have situations like a local mining site, what has gotten into the food chain at that particular area, or what has been released into a waterway from an upstream discharger, it's really difficult to know that.
Well, how about how are chemicals tested and determined to be safe in the U.S.? And how does that compare to Europe, for example?
Okay, there are two sets of chemicals. One, we're talking about food additives and things like that, chemicals used in food. And there are testing procedures for that before they're added. There are some unintentional chemicals, of course, like some of the packaging materials that leach into the food. That's kind of a different question. The chemicals in commerce, which Diane knows more about, unfortunately, in this country, the philosophy has been that they're probably safe unless they're proven harmful, and that has resulted in a lot of environmental contamination. But in Europe, they have a precautionary principle where you're supposed to prove that a chemical is safe before it can be released. So it's a preventive, precautionary kind of rule that it's being talked about in this country, but we're not there yet. But Diane can talk more about that.
Diane, what do you think about this precautionary principle versus the waiting until something happens and then we'll deal with it?
Well, it makes all the sense in the world that the people in this country should push their legislatures as the Toxic Substance Control Act is under active discussion in the Congress to be reformed, that this should be a principle that guides that legislation. I think it's very important. At the beginning of the show, you had people reading different chemicals, and there's, so many chemicals that have not been tested and are allowed in commerce that something has to be done to address this in a, comprehensive manner that fully embraces the precautionary principle.
Diane, are there any chemicals or any foods that you absolutely won't eat because you're concerned about the chemicals in them?
You know, I was listening in fascination, and Valerie, I wish I had her knowledge. There's not typically foods that my family avoids. I ask my children not to, drink, the Mountain Dew with the brominated vegetable oil. But I just don't have enough knowledge, and I think the general consumer doesn't either on chemicals in commerce. You assume that something's on the shelf is safe and that the federal government is somehow protecting us, but that is not always the case because chemicals are allowed in commerce before they're tested, as Barbara was saying, and it's just a kind of a backwards way of looking at things. And so the consumer does not always know, and I consider myself an informed consumer, but I have a great deal to learn on this nutrition aspect.
What about you, Barbara? Are there any foods that you absolutely won't consume?
I have personally almost eliminated my canned tuna fish, except once, as a treat in a sandwich once or twice a year. I have, to some extent, reduced my amount of fish if I know something about the toxins in that fish. I think mercury is not on the additive perspective, but just from a environmental chemical perspective. I think mercury is something to avoid in food. Washington State has a statewide advisory on tuna fish.
Well, we're about to go to a break, but I want to let our audience know we are talking about chemicals in food today, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. Are you concerned about the chemicals finding their way into your traditional foods? Tell us about it. I particularly want to hear from folks from Alaska. Again, the number is 1-800-996-2848. Have you considered cutting back on your traditional foods because of maybe the mercury or other toxins found in them? You can also go to our Facebook page and post a message or send us a tweet. We'll be right back after this short break. You've seen the headlines. In Washington State, a Native high school student was told not to display an eagle feather at graduation. It's the same story in Nebraska and Oklahoma. Eagle feathers are symbols of honor in Native culture, so why aren't they allowed at commencements? We'll discuss on the next Native America Calling.
In the morning, as the sun arises, you wake me up with your smile and a kiss upon my cheek. Hey, hey, hello, hey, hello. Hey, oh, be I. Hey, oh, be I. Hey, oh, be I. Hey, I know. Hey, hey.
I'm Nathan. My job gave me a lot. It gave me an income to support my family. It gave me purpose and pride. But the secondhand smoke there triggered my severe asthma attacks, infections, and lung damage. And I never smoked. It was so bad that my doctor told me I shouldn't work there anymore. I had to quit my job. But the damage was done. Now I'm so sick, I can't do much of anything I used to love to do. I don't referee youth basketball anymore. I don't run or lift weights. It's too much for my body to take. Instead, I'm taking breathing treatments or oxygen. I guess you could say my job gave me a lot. So let me give you a tip. Don't let people tell you that working around secondhand smoke is safe.
Smoking affects more than just your health. If you or someone you know wants free help to quit smoking, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, sitting in for Tara Gatewood. You can hear Native America Calling each weekday on radio stations across the country, including the one you're listening to right now. We also stream on Native Voice One, that is NV1.org. If you'd like to know about our upcoming shows, go to our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. We've been talking about chemicals in our food. Earlier this month, the restaurant chain Panera announced that they would be removing 150 artificial additives from their food. It's another voice in the growing movement to reduce the amount of chemicals in the food we consume. But where does Native America fit into this conversation? Have you ever put something back on the shelf because you couldn't pronounce what it was in it? Or do you think this is a big controversy over nothing? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got Valerie Segrist with us. She is the Muckleshoot Traditional Food and Medicine Program Manager. And we've also got Diane Barton. She's the water quality coordinator for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And Dr. Barbara Harper, she's a consultant. She's been working on toxins in Indian country for over 20 years, and she is a board-certified toxicologist. Valerie, before the break, we were talking a little bit about chemicals that you absolutely want to avoid in your food. But I also wanted to ask you, you know, when you're trying to make the choice or the decisions to sort of eliminate certain chemicals or eliminate foods that may be harmful to you, how can you do this without breaking the bank, particularly when we consider, you know, living in food deserts?
And when I think about that, it once again is a really wonderful opportunity to get more connected with a traditional way of managing your food, and that involves you gardening and harvesting and hunting and fishing to try to supplement your diet that way. It doesn't cost that. I think about a tomato seed and how you plant one tomato in a container and you get like one tomato seed and you get like 60 tomatoes off of each bush that grows, and how powerful that is, that teaching of abundance that's truly there when we take the time to pray over a seed and put our hands in the dirt and take care of our food. And that is really what I think our food system is asking of us. It's asking us to become more active, to become citizens and not just consumers, to look at the possible solutions that are there and not just all the nutritional deficiencies. When we can take that approach, things seem a little less apocalyptic and dreary and zombie apocalypse happening around us everywhere. It's an important time for us to start making decisions and painting a way for our youth and our people who are yet to come to eat a cleaner diet.
So you're saying stop, step back, take a deep breath, and reconnect.
That's right. And what a wonderful opportunity that presents to us.
Well, we are talking about chemicals in food today. And I want to ask you, Diane Barton, talk to us a little bit about flame retardants and why this is causing a problem in our traditional foods.
Well, flame retardants are a bioaccumulative toxic chemical that we have been measuring in the fish in our organization for probably the last 10 years. And it's been in the press. It is taken into the human body not only through the consumption of food but also through the material you sit on. If you're sitting on a fabric cloth that has flame retardants in it, you're taking some of that into your body. And so, but it also washes through the laundry. You're sitting on chairs, and as you do laundry, that flame retardant gets into the water and then cannot be removed by treatment plants, municipal wastewater treatment plants, so enters the environment where it's accumulated into fish tissue. So we're seeing that as a problem. The EPA has encouraged and successfully implemented voluntary bans on some of those flame retardants, but the industry seems to have moved to alternatives that are possibly also bioaccumulative. Those are being assessed right now by the EPA.
Diane, when you say bioaccumulative, what do you mean?
What I mean is a chemical that, as it is consumed by an animal, it is basically kind of collected into the tissue of the animal, and then as you go up the food chain to higher levels of predatory fish, they're continually eating, and the food that contains that. So you get high enough in the food chain, even though those chemicals might not be in the environment, like in the Arctic, in Alaska, a lot of these bioaccumulative chemicals are seen in the whale and the mammals, Arctic mammals, that are not even connected in those population centers. But because those chemicals accumulate in the food chain, we're seeing them where they're not even released in the environment.
That's really interesting. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rick in Spokane, Washington, listening on KSFC. Rick, you have a question for us.
Yeah, I have a question. I know there's a controversy, particularly around the Northwest, about fish consumption rates that are used in water quality standards and how those impact human health for toxics. And I'm just wondering, are the fish consumption rates that we have in the States, are those protective of the actual amount of fish that Native Americans eat, and what should we do to fix them?
That's a great question, Rick. Diane, I want to throw that to you. Are we considering the amount of fish that's being consumed, particularly maybe in tribal populations, when they make those recommendations about how much is safe to consume?
Yeah, this is just beginning to happen. The state of Oregon has moved to a fish consumption rate. Rick was talking about how that fits into water quality standards. States are required to set their standards based on a fish consumption rate. And in 2011, the state of Oregon chose a fish consumption rate based on a survey done by the organization I work for and set the standard for the state based on that tribal rate. It's actually a compromise rate. Barbara can weigh in on this, but traditional diets show much, much higher fish consumption than is even accepted by the state of Oregon. We can get into numbers on this, but, you know, 3 or 4 times the amount used in those state water quality standards in Oregon are what tribal people would and do consume. And then the states of Washington and Idaho are currently also considering this. It's almost tragic that the state of Alaska, probably where the most subsistence level fishing occurs, has a extremely low fish consumption rate. It's absolutely ridiculous, but hopefully that will change sometime in the near future.
Barbara, anything you want to add?
Only that the Spokane tribe has water quality standards for their reservation that is based on a fully traditional rate. You can find that on the EPA webpage if people are interested. Most other tribes are not quite there yet, but statewide, off-reservation, that's where the problem comes.
Well, we are talking about chemicals in food today, and would you like to see your tribe or your state or federal government regulating the toxins that get into our water, that get into our traditional foods, or that even come in our prepackaged foods? There's still time for you to get in on the conversation. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mike in Buffalo Springs, New Mexico, tuned in on KGLP. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment that, you know, ramen noodle was pretty good and got me through school, so I have no objections with that. but my main point is that being a diabetic of 28 years, that we have to really take time to read the labels to see, besides the sodium and the sugar content and all that stuff, some of those other artificial ingredients, which I, most of the time, like everybody, can't even read or know what the name is or pronounce it. And when you're a diabetic, you have to really watch what you consume in order to maintain and control your diabetes, you know. So it's important to make sure that you read and try to understand and maybe look up and Google to find out what's good and what isn't, as well as questioning your physician also. That's my point.
Thanks, Mike, for giving us a call from Buffalo Springs, New Mexico, listening on KGLP. Valerie, any special considerations that diabetics should be thinking about when it comes to making our food plans and checking out the chemicals? Are there some chemicals that may be even more harmful for diabetics?
I don't know specifically if there are any specific chemicals. I do know that, you know, we're experiencing what some of us are calling in holistic health practicing as the one disease, which is that there is this overload of stress in our life. There's a lack of connectivity to community and food. There are nutritional deficiencies everywhere. Our microbiomes, all of our friendly bacteria in our guts and on our skin are being disrupted by all of the antibiotics everywhere around us. And then there's this toxicity in the environment. And all of those things support systemic inflammation, which is diseases like diabetes and heart disease, food intolerances and autoimmune diseases like Crohn's disease, leaky gut, IBS. Those kinds of things are all part of that bigger picture. And so that's why I say, like, first and foremost, chill out. Like, we got to stop stressing. It's everywhere around us, and that is the number one thing that involves self-mastery. And then also just pay attention. Pay attention to the toxicity in your environment and what you can do to make it better. But, yes, there are, you know, things in our environment, those toxins that support inflammation in our cells, which make it really hard for us to balance our blood glucose. So it is important to consider. And really, the number one thing you can do is stop eating fried foods. You know, fried foods are like barbed wire in your blood vessels. They create inflammation everywhere and make it very hard for your body to regulate blood sugar.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Vicki in Anchorage, Alaska, tuned in on KNBA. Vicki, what would you like to share about chemicals in food?
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I live in Anchorage now, but I grew up in the interior part of Alaska. And the concern that I have that has never really been addressed, to my knowledge, is back in the day when we had a lot of military in Alaska, you know, because of all the wars and stuff that were going on, and they were protecting the United States. you know, there were a lot of military bases, and then the military, everything settled down and they up and left. And what they did is they dug big holes in the ground and buried a lot of stuff. And there was a point in time as I was growing up where we had a number of people lose their lives because they had colon cancer or rectal cancer or, you know, similar stomach cancer. And I really believe that there was stuff that was buried in our grounds that our, you know, our moose ate, that grew up into our blueberries and things. And you know, I love the traditional lifestyle, but I'm still a little bit leery about that. And I just wanted to share that. It sure would be nice to have whoever, the government or somebody, take a look at that and figure out if there is stuff that's, you know, in the ground that's damaging our traditional foods.
Thanks for that, Vicki. Diane, I want to throw that to you. When we're talking about old sites or even Superfund sites and it connecting to our traditional foods, how difficult is it to be able to connect those dots and really say, this caused this?
I'm afraid I'm not really an expert on the Superfund situation. I think that everyone should definitely consider, you know, what impacts the food in the food web that they're consuming from. But, I go back to what Valerie said, eat with your ancestors. You know, when you're weighing traditional foods against, you know, some market foods that have a lot of chemicals, I think the fear shouldn't overtake us on that all the traditional foods are contaminated. And I don't want to give that impression from our knowledge of the fish. There is contamination, but we must all work together to limit that and over time reduce the level of the contaminants in these traditional foods.
Barbara, I understand, though, that it is very tricky to be able to really connect the dots and to be able to say this particular thing is causing this. Why is that?
Well, it's a question of statistics. When you have small populations, you just don't get the increase in disease that you can actually attribute to a particular cause. It's very difficult to trace back from something that looks like a cluster of disease back to a source. If you think about cancer, if you have a chemical that's regulated to 1 in a million, that means 1 million people with confirmed exposure would have to be exposed in order to find one extra case. And in small tribal populations, you just don't have the numbers. So what regulators more often do is regulate based on risk rather than based on a disease confirmation. The way the risk is evaluated is to do the animal tests and add some safety factors with the intent of preventing the disease in the first place. Now, that's not to say that cumulative environmental exposure didn't attribute or contribute to that particular outcome. They could well have, but proving it is very difficult.
Do you think it's a good system, though, to test these sorts of things on animals and then to base a conclusion based on those limited runs?
Well, the other option is that the option is to not allow the chemical in the first place or to wait for people to get sick, and you don't want to wait till people get sick. So your options are to allow a little bit based on animal tests or not to allow it at all. And that's as much a policy question as it is a science question.
Well, let's talk about policy. Diane, I know that you're the chair of the National Tribal Toxics Council. What policies do you find or do you think are critical when it comes to this conversation about toxins in our traditional foods or even in our traditional plants?
Well, the number one recommendation that our council has made to the Environmental Protection Agency is to consider tribal exposure when they're conducting risk assessments on chemicals that are under their authority to regulate. And this has not really been done. They look at an average person consuming products from a marketplace and base their decisions on this average and don't look at unique tribal exposures. So that's what we have asked, and not just our council, but tribal representatives who work with the EPA for years have asked EPA to specifically consider how tribal members are exposed to chemicals and toxics in the environment in their under their regulatory authority.
Is there any need to go beyond the EPA with this, or are they the final stop?
Well, the area of EPA that we work with only considers toxics in commercial products. You know, there's the Federal Food and Drug Administration is, and Valerie probably knows more about their authority, regulates all these chemicals that we've been talking about this morning in food.
Valerie, what do you think about regulation of the food? Would you like to see more tribes pass laws outlawing certain chemicals, or should we be moving this up through the Food and Drug Administration, really asking for some basic changes?
That, you know, honestly is a major question I have. I learned last year when we passed a resolution, Muckleshoot started a resolution on genetically engineered salmon that is right now on the table at the FDA to be approved or disapproved. And we took it through the National Congress of American Indians and took it all the way through the nation and got it passed to be placed in the FDA's hands saying, Indian country stands against, we oppose the introduction of genetically modified salmon into our environment. And I haven't heard anything back, you know. It's been a year, actually, next month that has actually happened. And I do know that while the EPA has discussions with tribes, the FDA does not. So I think that would be a really important key piece to, you know, government-to-government relations that needs to happen is tribes need to be in conversation with the FDA. So when they want to pass another, you know, strand of genetically modified corn, they have to talk to people who hold that food as a sacred food, defining who they are and their identity. They have to actually have a discussion with them. And that does not happen currently. So it's a major breakdown on the Hill, and I don't really know how to move forward with it. I've been sort of perplexed with the idea for about a year now. And at the same time, you know, I'm working closely with my tribal council, checking in on what our people are doing back in D.C. to make sure that those genetically modified salmon species do not hit our waters market in any way.
Right. Why do you think that the FDA doesn't consult with tribes?
Because they don't think they have to. They don't. That is the word on the street. It's not like I don't know if it's a superiority complex. I don't want to imply that at all. But I think that it just hasn't been considered. And to be quite honest, the FDA could be more empowered by our federal government. You know, they have a tremendous, they are managing thousands of foods that are on the market where people are able to just make claims on labels, print it out, and wait for the FDA to catch up for them. So they're inundated with a lot of regulations and making decisions and not being swayed by scientific findings that cherry pick evidence that makes their product look good. They could be more empowered by our government and also required, as the EPA is, to speak to tribal communities.
Barbara, earlier you mentioned that European standards are more stringent than they are in the U.S. Is this a question of what, you know, consumers in Europe demanding these sorts of things, or is there something else going on?
I actually don't know if commercial foods are more highly regulated or not. Chemicals in commerce, I think, are because of the precautionary principle, but the commercial packaged foods, which is what FDA deals with, I'm not sure. And I would also add that I suspect that FDA thinks they don't need to consult with tribes because they deal with commercial foods, but to miss the link that wild foods like GMO salmon or crops, those are out in the environment and not just in packaged food. So there does need to be more outreach from FDA.
Diane, we are almost at the end of our hour. Anything you want to leave us with in terms of what we should be considering when we make choices about traditional foods or even foods in our grocery stores?
Well, I the only thing I would add is the obligation of anybody who's purchasing chemicals to understand the whole life history of them, that they go through your body, they're released into the environment, and this all comes back again to your family. So make wise choices. There's websites out there that, you know, recommend some choices. EPA has a Safer Choice program. And really, it's the consumer needs to step up, take the responsibility, and look into those sources of information.
And where can folks learn more about the National Tribal Toxics Council?
There is a website, which I would be able to give you, but I don't know off the top of my head. If you just Google National Tribal Toxics Council, we have a website where we post information on tribal consultation and chemicals that are currently under review. A lot of information, but I don't have the website.
We'll put a link up on our webpage. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thanks to Valerie Segrist, Dr. Barbara Harper, and Dr. Diane Barton. We're back tomorrow with a show about yearly graduation fights over wearing feathers or beaded caps. Our interim executive producer is Tristan Autone. Tara Gatewood is the host and producer of our show. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Stephen Emmons is our engineer. Kaveh Movahed screened our calls today. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer of National Native News. I'm senior producer Monica Brain. We'll see you tomorrow.
This program supported by the Peace Corps, the government agency sending thousands of volunteers to live and work alongside people in more than 60 countries worldwide. The Peace Corps will allow you to share your unique cultural heritage and promote world peace and friendship. We have rewarding work opportunities around the world in education, health, agriculture, environment, and business. It will change your life and the lives of others. More information available at peacecorps.gov. That's peacecorps.gov.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization located in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Music is provided by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.